Yeah, I did. I forgot his name. I'm sorry. So our next presentation on transmitter maintenance and troubleshooting tips. Our presenter, as you know, is Jeff Weldon with Nautel. Thank you, Jay. Jeff has presented here many times. I've had the pleasure of introducing him quite a few times also. He's been with Nautel since 1990, spent 17 years in customer service before going into sales for the last 7 years or so in there. And and we'll continue from there. Here's Jeff. Thanks.
Very cool. Oh, they can hear me now. No, I want that.
Okay.
That was really good. He was supposed to put in a bunch of sarcasm and stuff. I was expecting to hear something about my cigarettes and various things like that that I take abuse for. Oh, look, I've only got 7 minutes and 2 seconds to go. This is going to be fast. Am I just going to wave at Cliff whenever I want the slides to be advanced?
What?
Advancing slides? Is there a clicker?
The red button is for the slide change.
The red button.
I do the audio. He does
the. So they asked me to talk about maintenance and troubleshooting, and oh, look, now we got 45 minutes. I told them that I had it fixed in my head. I've very firmly set that I'm only allowed to speak from 3:45 till 4:30 because I don't want anybody to have to stay too long. 4:30 is a long way away. So we're talking primarily about maintenance and troubleshooting. Be brutally honest, in 45 minutes, I'm probably going to cover a lot more maintenance and a little less troubleshooting because ultimately, the more maintenance you do, the less troubleshooting you have to do, theoretically. Oh, yay-hoo. There's really only a few things that kill equipment. Transients, of course, lightning strikes, some of the nasties. Has anybody ever had a nice power surge? There's a hand in the back. I had a customer in Arkansas not too long ago where the power company decided to clear a switching relay that was stuck down the chain. Do you know that how they clear the switching relays? They fire a 2,000-volt pulse down the line. The theory is it's a really fast pulse and it doesn't go anywhere except directly to that relay. Unfortunately, if you got a couple of other relays closed in the chain because somebody forgot to throw another switch, then it does all kinds of things to everything in that chain. And it blew a bunch of stuff up. Temperature is the other big equipment killer. And this, a lot of this stuff, most of it, will apply to tube as well as solid state. Okay, everybody says like a tube transmitter will run through lightning. Yes, it will. But you shorten the lifespan every time you put a surge across it. They'll run hotter. Yes, they will. But again, you're shortening the lifespan. Okay, if you have to replace a tube every 1 year instead of every 5 years, that's an effect on the bottom line. And then obviously internal arcing, which typically is caused by dust. So if you've got a little dust built up, and this is where I am going to belabor the dust buster or the vacuum cleaner as your best friend when it comes to keeping stuff from blowing up in the first place. There we go. Okay, so for lightning and transient protection, I'm not doing the whole lightning protection presentation here because I've got 41 minutes left and I can't do it that fast. But the big things we want to do is conduct our strike pulse to ground and we want it not to go through our equipment on the way. Now here's something to think about. When lightning hits your FM tower, the tower typically is already connected to ground. What happens is that that energy is looking for a way to dissipate, and it needs a big sheet of conductive material to do that. Well, it's got two choices, the earth and the power lines. So if we get an antenna strike and we raise our ground potential way high, it's going to look for power lines, and that's when your power supplies fail. If You hear a lot of times, most power supply failures are not caused by power company issues. Okay, they're caused by transient energy spiking back and feeding through the power supply in the opposite direction. So one of the first things we can do is connect in. If anybody was here last year or the year before, I forget when I did lightning protection, you've probably seen one or two of these slides, just from a different tactic. But everybody's familiar with bulkhead grounds, where your coaxes all come into the building, you connect your shields all to a ground, bus bar, and then you connect that with a big heavy strap to your earth ground. And everybody has those in all their sites, right? Or not? Of course, the problem becomes when your ground strap comes out of the room, you've got everything perfectly laid out in the room, and the ground strap comes out, but the copper thieves cut it off and stole everything outside. And that's the case. This is another site. This one's in Missouri, I think it was. But we kicked the bushes away and fought the chiggers and discovered that that ground strap ended right there. So that's another perfect example of something where a little preventative maintenance, a site inspection, a little bit of weed whacking, they potentially could have saved themselves several thousand dollars in replacement parts. That guy on the left, that's not a ground. Don't care what they tell you, it's not a ground. Okay? The guy on the right, is anybody got a ground system where you've got copper cable and you got those little compression clamps, the little ground bar clamps holding the cable to the ground rod? You know what I mean? The problem with those, and this is something, and this gets back into transmitters, anytime you run a copper wire into a compression connection, whether it's one of those Tinnerman clamps where you just clamp it down, whether it's a regular Amphenol crimp that wasn't crimped tightly enough to get all the air out. Anytime you do that, copper's very malleable. It will compress. And what happens when it compresses? It becomes loose. The guy on the right is the station owner. Don't let it be said, owners don't do any work. We walked in, they had just installed, they had rebuilt the entire ground system less than 6 months before I walked into that site. I walked up to the primary ground, they had a really nice 4-inch strap coming out of the building with a 2-aught cable brazed to it, beautifully done, running down to one of these compression clamps to a ground rod because they couldn't find any of the little explosive forms that you put on MIG weld, TIG weld, whatever they're called. CAD weld, thank you. Those are cool things. Anytime you get to play with explosives and grounding at the same time, that's good stuff. Anyway, so they had one of these little compression clamps holding this big honking cable onto this ground rod. And I walked over and I go, oh, that's a nice ground connection, and grabbed it and came up with the end of the cable in my hand. Okay, 6 months was all the time it took. And he swore up and down. It had been tightened as far as they could tighten it. When you're doing a compression connection, it needs to be compressed to the point that the cables are squished so that there is no air in there, no room for them to compress any farther. Anybody ever put on an Amphenol-type crimp connector? There's a hand in the back, a couple of hands. And you notice how they got those ratchets on them. And you have to get it all the way to the last click before you can release it and get it off. Do you know those tools need to be calibrated and checked? Because they do eventually, metal bends and they don't become as tight. So you'll take it till it clicks, but you still haven't made a good crimp. Okay, so that's something else to keep in mind, tool maintenance. Surge protection, you've heard me beat this drum a million times. You don't need to hear me beat it one more time, but you're going to. You need a surge protector at your facility. Studio, site, both ends. We provide one. We don't care if you use ours. I really don't care at all. Polyphaser makes a good one. LEA, Transtector, Control Concepts. I can think of 3 or 4 right off the top of my head. Any decent quality surge protector, preferably MOV based because it'll conduct the strike fast. There are some of the gallium arsenide ones are good. Anything to conduct that energy And here's the thing, we're conducting two ways. If you get a power line surge for any reason, like they fired that 2,000 volt spike down the line, it'll conduct that to ground. If you get a surge on your ground connection because you had a massive discharge from the tower, it'll conduct it to the AC lines. They're bidirectional. Okay? It's one of the reasons we tell you put it as close as you can to the AC entrance, because the AC cabling has got a higher inductance. We want the lowest inductance possible between the power line and ground through the surge box. Then we use more cabling going to our equipment and increase the inductance there and make the surge box look like the better path. What's this about? Yeah, hand in the back. Okay, what Chris is saying is that it's important, and he's got a point, that at your entrance panel, your neutral and ground should be bonded together. Historically, it's always been done out on the pull pig, and you weren't allowed to do it, but apparently NEC allows for that now.
It's been quote for years.
22, he said, yep. But you'd be surprised how many we see where they're not like that. I've physically measured 185 volts between neutral and ground on a site before. Yep, so definitely you should have that tied together. I don't think about it. What's that, Gary?
You're trying to tell me something, Cliff? Now, that's been code for years. You only ground it at the main entrance panel, and then there are two ground rods with it. But the grounding and the strap and a transmitter site are far more important than that.
Okay. Now, the other thing that we push a lot is ferrites. And I've described these before. A ferrite is a common mode protection against surges. Basically, you have your feed and your return going through the same ferrite. And if you get a surge on either, it will attempt to induce an equal surge on the other one. And what that does is between your feed and your return, we keep the potential difference the same, because the difference between your voltage carrying conductor and ground is what blows equipment up. You spike one up or spike the other up, that's when you have a failure. If they both go up and down at the same rate, transmitter doesn't care, processor, whatever, it just sees the same voltage as always. Okay, so ferrites on everything. Definitely on your coax lines, you want ferrites on your AC lines. When you're running a ferrite, remember you need the feed and the return. So if you're on three phase, all three phases plus your safety ground through the one ferrite. Put them on STLs, on sample lines if you're running an AM. If you're running any kind of other equipment at the site, processors, remote controls, all that stuff can have ferrite put on it. You can buy little clip-on ones that go on RJ45 cables. If you're running power over Ethernet, or if you've got a nano bridge, something like that for wireless IP connectivity. Okay, ferrite's on everything. If current goes through it and there's a feed and a return, it should have a ferrite on it. You can get them anywhere. There's a company called Amidon you can find with a web search, Amidon, if anybody's writing it down. I think it's called Tech Amidon on their website. They provide them for primarily ham use. The purpose doesn't matter. You want the one with the most metal content you can get, because we're looking at common mode. So we don't really care. We're not interested. We're not winding a choke where it matters where what frequency it saturates at. We want the most metal we can get. Oops. Is there a backup button on this? The yellow button. There we go. One other thing I'd forgotten to mention, ferrite is an awesome troubleshooting tool, especially for RF-type circuitry. If you've got an AM site, you put a ferrite at the transmitter output, you put another ferrite at the phaser input, and another ferrite on each phaser output, and one of those ferrites gets hot, you got a ground loop. Because your feed and your return currents are not equal, and the ferrite's saturating. So you can tell by touching it. If it's ambient temperature, you've done it right. If you've got any kind of increase in temperature on your ferrite, then you know you've got a problem, a situation that should be addressed before you have a lightning strike and have a failure. Okay, so both for maintenance and troubleshooting, a ferrite's just a really useful thing. All right, so we put them, like I said, we put them everywhere. That's a picture of 1 kilowatt. You got ferrites on the coax, you got ferrites on the AC. As I said, especially in a three-phase scenario, you need all your phases, all your feeds, and the return, the ground, going through the same ferrite for the purpose we're using it for. Okay, like I said, we're not creating chokes with it. It's just used for common mode protection. Here we go. I knew I had something in there that told me everywhere I could put them. You can put them everywhere. Like I said, feed, return, put a ferrite on it. Yeah, Chris. There, say that again so I don't have to repeat it.
For one 300, or for one AC feed through a ferrite, do you loop the wire 360 degrees one turn around the ferrite?
Basically, the way I try to do it is, number one, it depends on the flexibility of the wire. Of course, if you're running a 50 or 100 kilowatt transmitter and you got 4-aught cable, you're not going to put a turn in it. But as many as you can conveniently do, given the physical size of the ferrite and the ability to turn the turn radius on the cable you're using, yes, definitely looping it through is better. After about two turns through, you hit a point of diminishing returns where you're not really creating enough improvement to bother with the effort. Similar to putting ferrite on coax. After about two or three ferrites on a piece of coax, you're not really improving anything after that. You're just adding cost to the project. Part of your maintenance and troubleshooting. If you've got something that's giving you SWR alarms, or you've got a problem with items failing because every time a storm rolls through, something blows up, do a physical walkthrough. Like I said before, with the guy where I walked in and grabbed his primary ground conductor and yanked it right out of the ground rod. Okay, check all of those grounding connections. They should be checked typically every year or so anyway. Okay, maintenance these days, I break it down to whenever I'm at the site, plus monthly, plus yearly. The yearly one of them would be inspecting the ground system, and as a minimum, especially on an AM site, walking around and looking for things like this. Okay, that's a static drain choke that is not a static drain choke anymore. All right, do a physical inspection. There it is. Look for little things like, I don't know, birds' nests in your tuning units. Mice is another really good one. How many people have ever had to pull a snake out of a transmitter? How many people have ever had a mouse build a nest in a transmitter? How many people have ever had to clean up the goo that results as that? Isn't that all kinds of fun? All right, mouse proofing, surprisingly, in some sites it's not really feasible. I mean, if you've got an old wooden frame site with all kinds of holes in the walls, it's going to be a little more challenging to keep the critters out. Mothballs, a can of mothballs just sitting on the floor. Won't help the smell any, but it'll keep a lot of insects and rodents out. Okay, if you've got outdoor tuning units and phasers, a little dish of mothballs in each of those. Replace them every 6 months to a year. Okay, over the long haul, it can save you a lot of grief because mice can really destroy a piece of electronic equipment. Yeah, hand in the back.
On the subject of mothballs, I have read that you should be careful to distinguish between naphthalene and paradichlorobenzene mothballs. The latter can sometimes interact with the copper if you generate a spark in the ATU, for example, whereas the naphthalene are inert and they are the preferred.
The other issue is that the benzene-based ones over time will corrode copper, like on circuit boards and things like that. So definitely, yeah, naphtha-based mothballs are the choice that you want to go with. Otherwise, you're creating more problems than you're solving. Spark gaps. How many people run AM sites? More than a few. Okay, good. Then I won't skip over this one in a hurry. We'll spend a little time. How many people have spark gaps involved in their system? How many people check the spark gaps every year or so? I didn't get near as many hands that time. I did get quite a few, though. Spark gaps, every time, especially with antenna gaps where you've got the tungsten steel balls at the base of the tower, Every time they get a conduction, every time an arc goes across them, a little bit of metal migrates from one ball to the other ball. Well, after a little while, you got a whole bunch of peaks on this one, a whole bunch of valleys on this one, and now you don't have any idea at what voltage the spark gap will fire. So on the tungsten ones, you end up usually rotating the balls or filing down the peaks on the receiving side. Okay, we push these carbon balls a lot. You can buy them from a company in California called Ross Engineering. You can buy them already threaded, so you can just thread them right on. And they don't suffer from any kind of migration. Now, of course, everything's got its pluses and its minuses. If you get that 1 in a million killer lightning strike, these things will explode. They'll shatter. But it's really rare. I've only ever seen one set fail so far in 15 years of using them. And they're always, always, always predictable. Well, here's something else, spark gap. Anybody got an idea where, let's say I had a 50 kilowatt running, okay, well, the base of an antenna, the high impedance, let's go 100 ohms. Got a guess at what the spark gap setting should be? Be about 1/4 of an inch. Now, working backwards, 5 kilowatt, how many people run 5 kilowatt stations? A couple of hands. 5 kilowatts into 50 ohms, where should my spark gaps be set? If I had a spark gap at the ATU input, for example. Chris is holding his fingers really close together. About that, 10/1000ths of an inch, 1/100th of an inch. That will handle all your power plus your modulation without arcing under normal conditions, assuming that they're indoors or out of the weather so that they don't arc every time the dew rises or every time you get a lightning storm or a rainstorm. Well, lightning storm, you want them to arc. Or every time a mosquito flies by. At 100 kilowatt in Botswana once, VSWR problems. Every time they turned around, the thing was shutting down for VSWR. Be a clear day, no wind, nothing. Transmitter shut down because of VSWR. Engineer finally sent us an email, said, I resolved it. Sent us a picture. They had ants, and the ants walked along and walked up the arm of one of the balls, and they got to the middle between the balls and got vaporized. And what he sent us, a close-up picture of about 10,000 little ant legs stuck to this one ball. And now it's arcing any time at all. So they cleaned it up, and what they basically did in that case was just wrapped it in plastic and tape. I've weatherproofed antenna, base antenna, ball gaps, just by taking a Javax jug, cut the bottom up, cut a slot down, slam it on, there you go, a little bit of duct tape, you're done. It's good till next year. Remember that plastic does deteriorate. You'll have to replace that every now and again. Okay, so remember to check the spacing. Steel balls do require more maintenance, like the tungsten ones at the base of a tower. You have to file them down and turn them every now and again. Horn gaps, if you've got the Jacob's ladder or horn gaps in your ATUs, you need to inspect those fairly regularly. One good storm will wear those out pretty badly. Okay, so it's something to keep in mind. Here's something else. Anything that isn't live should be grounded. Okay, here's an example showing the safety wire coming down to a ground rod. You know that safety wire that goes through the turnbuckles on your guy wires? And then they ground that safety wire. There's a reason for that. And the reason has very little to do with voltage coming down the guy wires. Well, it does, because we're trying to run it to ground around the concrete anchor. Because concrete has a very high moisture content. And what happens when you throw a lot of current through a puddle of water? It turns to steam in a hurry. And what happens when you convert water to steam very quickly? It expands. You can destroy a concrete anchor on a good lightning strike. What happens when you destroy the concrete anchor that's holding up the tower? That's right, it just makes it even easier. It's like putting the oven element right in the middle. So definitely as part of your maintenance run, you should be doing a fairly frequent inspection of base anchors. Okay, because there's nothing worse than finding out that one of them let go. I mean, definitely there are some things, and I know you've got tower-related talks coming up, so I'm not getting too far into that. But the integrity of the base anchors is one way to help make sure the towers stay vertical, and they seem to work better that way. Okay, we've got a bunch of AM people here. Has everybody got insulated towers, mostly? Everybody's got Johnny balls or the little compression insulators on there? Everybody inspects them every year or so with a set of binoculars to make sure they don't look like that. Once an insulator arcs, it develops a carbon track. Okay, the next time it'll arc at a slightly lower voltage and it'll build up that carbon track. And more until it's not an insulator anymore, it's a conductor. And when that happens, then you'll be calling us going, my transmitter keeps shutting down with SWR, but it works great in the dummy load. And it's like, well, you don't have a transmitter problem. You've got a something else problem. This is one of the causes we see a lot. How many people have those fiberglass rod insulators anywhere in their facility? You got to inspect those too, because if that fiberglass coating comes off, the epoxy that they put over the top of them, what you've got underneath is a piece of wood covered with fiberglass that soaks up moisture like a sponge. Once you get it wet, again, it's not an insulator anymore. Okay, so they do need to be physically inspected as part of a scheduled maintenance program. Airflow. I think I had this one last year too, although I don't know if I had the after. I took that picture about 6 months ago. This is the same site. The before picture shows the air intake coming through that big honking pipe at the top and blowing it up where all the exhaust air goes from all the transmitters. There's two of them in the room. The feed return is right underneath, matter of fact, right behind the transmitter, so it's drawing air away from the transmitter intake. That's kind of negatively pressurizing things. That transmitter was getting hotter than a pistol. The room would be, on average, about 75 degrees. And the transmitter exhaust air would be on the high side of 130. So what we did was reworked it so that the intake duct dumped the air behind the transmitter and we put an exhaust hood on it. They, in this case, put it backup AC units, but they've never been on. Okay, what they had was more than sufficient. It was just pointed in the wrong places. So little things like that, again, a maintenance sweep, you can run through your whole facility in an afternoon. Start at one end, work your way to the other end. I tell people, start at the antenna, pretend you're a bolt of lightning, work your way back to the power panel, and then walk around and look for things that are hot or things that need to be tightened up. Keeping it clean is really, really, really important. I cannot stress this enough. How many people do regular trips to the transmitter site to clean it up? How many people don't have time to do those? I'm going to say I see one or two hands. How many people have the time, even though they don't have time to do that, to go out and repair it after it blows up? Okay, it's not a matter of if you fill a transmitter full of dust, eventually something will arc. Has anybody ever had to replace the plate blocker in an FM25K? Has anybody had to replace the plate blocker or a doorknob capacitor or a tube socket in anything? Has anybody had to replace the filter in a solid state transmitter? All right, almost all of those things can be caused by temperature and dust buildup. And keeping them clean, wipe it down with a damp rag. Remember, when you do that, you're working in a high voltage area. Shut the thing down and use the grounding stick. And hey, how many people were here when I gave the talk, I think it was last summer, about safety shoes? There was a bunch of other things, but safety shoes were in there. How many of those people have a pair of safety shoes now? I'm looking at you, Doc, because I saw your hand go up. Chuck, I saw your hand go up too. $50 at Walmart, people. They'll keep you alive when you get across 18,000 volts. All right, if you work on transmitters, you need a set of safety shoes. I'm getting off the topic, I'll be right back. Okay, but those are a huge thing. Look for a pair of shoes with the little ohm sign on them. Like I said, Walmart sells them steel toe, steel plate, slip resistant, and shock resistant. And that's what you're looking for, is the ESR rating, the shock resistance. It'll make a huge difference in your lifespan someday, hopefully. So clean equipment's happy equipment. The cleaner you keep it, the longer it'll last. If nothing else, going through the gear once a year with a wrench, tightening up all the nuts and bolts in the power supply and the RF sections, even if nowhere else at all, checking your ground system and keeping the air filters clean, wiping down the dust, will go a long way towards saving you from failures. Okay, and this is not brand specific. It doesn't matter whose transmitter you have. It doesn't matter whether it's a tube rig. It doesn't matter whether it's a solid state rig. Okay, this and the hardware checks will go a long way. Yeah, there are some that are a little more prone to fail than others. But if we can make it better, that's not a bad thing. This is a 50 kilowatt. Has anybody seen this picture before? There's somebody that pays attention way too often in all my talks then. This is the bowl insulator on the ATU output for a 50 kilowatt AM. What you're looking at in the bottom half of that bowl insulator is a collection of Arkansas dirt and an ant's nest. And every time the humidity got up, which of course it never does in Arkansas, the transmitter would go off the air. The SWR protection would shut it down. Went through everything. They went through everything. They redid grounding. They weren't losing any parts. They were having no failures. But they went through it stem to stern, up, down, sideways, left, right, center, and they finally called me out. I get there and I walked out, and of course, we were several hours into it at this point, and I said, we cleaned that bowl insulator out, and it hasn't hiccuped with SWR since. Now they've had a few other issues with grounding. Theirs was the site where the ground system got stolen. They had a lightning storm before they found out that the ground system was gone and blew a couple of modules. But the SWR shutbacks, totally solved. Back to safety for a second. When you're working on this big stuff, does everybody got a ground wand? Does everybody know how to make one? All you need is three things. You need a wooden broomstick, you need a set of jumper cables like you use to start your car in the winter, and I'm sure almost everybody has a set of those, and you need a roll of duct tape to tie the two together. Instant ground wand. 5 minutes to slap one together, even if you don't happen to have one at the site. You can ground your antenna if you're working on an AM. Ground the antenna. Because remember that an AM stick will pick up signal radiated from other AM antennas that you may not even know about or that you may not be thinking about. So just because you shut down the transmitter and you're getting ready to go work on the ATU, don't assume that the ATU is not hot unless you put a ground rod at the base of the tower. I know I'm drifting off topic, but I figure the more of you guys I got here to babble about maintenance too next year, the better off it is. So if we can throw a safety topic or two in there, I'm going to. Okay, so lockouts if you're working on anything with hot AC in it, especially if there's more than one person at the site, because it's just too easy for somebody to shut something off and be doing something and then somebody else to notice that it's off and switch it back on. Okay, this is another maintenance related issue. And this comes back to something that I've beaten the drum on before. When you're looking at your site inspection, how many people do thermal measurements of the circuit breakers in the site? How many people measure the temperature of the circuit breakers in their studio facility? All right, grab a Fluke infrared thermometer, $60 or $70, you can buy them online. Because again, it's a copper connector with compression. They can become loose. When they get loose, they get hot. Bad things happen. Has anybody ever had a transmitter site fire that was just pointed back to a power panel? Not yet. I've had two this year. There's a hand in the back again. Circuit breaker connections get loose, they overheat. It doesn't take a lot to start a wood frame building on fire if that's what you got for a transmitter site. You should check the temperature on your breakers regularly. Oh, look, there's the tool to do it with, too. Okay, so to recap so far, if we were looking at an annual maintenance schedule, I'd be checking the connections in my ground system. I'd be looking at my spark gaps. I'd be tightening all of the nuts and bolts in the transmitter, especially in the power supply and in an AM rig in the filter or the RF cabinets. I'd be doing the same thing on my AM station out at the ATUs in the phaser. And I'd be measuring the temperature on my circuit breakers. All right, remember, we don't want to see one of these things burning down. This comes back to the temperature thing too. Maintenance checks will go a long way toward reducing your cost of operation. Fans, whether it's the muffin fans we use here, whether it's the squirrel cage blowers that you use in the big tube rigs, have a life expectancy. They have a quoted, specified lifespan. And they're usually quoted at 40 degrees Celsius, which is about 140 Fahrenheit, no, a little less than that. It's about 90 Fahrenheit, I guess. A little more, in that range. Oh shoot, it's 96.8 because that's body temperature. 98.6, it's body temperature. For every 18 degrees Fahrenheit that you reduce the ambient temperature of that fan, you've doubled its lifespan. So if you drop it 36 degrees down to 60, a little above 60, you've multiplied the lifespan by a factor of 4. Okay, the longer you can keep it running. And don't forget that these little guys, not so much, but those big blowers, a lot of them have bearings. A lot of bearings have lubrication ports. How often do you lubricate the bearings in your air handling equipment? Okay, that stuff all has scheduled maintenance intervals. And these days, especially with Excel spreadsheets and BlackBerry reminders or whatever real phone you've got. Don't laugh too loud. I got a BlackBerry in my pocket. Anyway, it's just there's no reason why we can't create a specified maintenance interval for the equipment specifically under our care. Granted, yes, it's going to take a full day to go through a transmitter site and do all the maintenance stuff. If you're only doing it once a year. If you're doing it every 6 months, it may take a little less. Won't take half a day because nothing ever takes half a day. All right? But it will save you several days in the long haul. Troubleshooting tip. Anything that has a cover panel, if you had to take the panel off to work on something, before you turn it on, put the panel back. Couple of things to think about. Number one, in this particular picture, that's one of our old 5-kilowatt transmitters. The Lexan, the clear plexiglass panel in front of the modules is necessary for airflow, for cooling the amplifiers and the filter. And if you run the transmitter for 5 minutes with that panel off, depending on how hot you're running it, a lot of them will start to shut down. Okay, if you bypass the thermal protection, because we never ever bypass protection, of course, ever. It will take about 10 minutes before it starts to cook the filter. It'll take about 20 minutes after that before that really thick yellow smoke that we love so much comes out of the cast mica capacitors. All right. If you're working on AM gear, working on a phaser, on an ATU, in a transmitter filter, doing a component replacement, the filter cabinet is part of the electrical circuit. There are circulating currents in it. When you remove that cover, you've changed the tuning of the network. At that point, there's no point taking the cover off and tweaking it to adjust it. Oh, I got it perfect now, and then you put the cover on and wonder why you've got SWR. Measurements need to be taken with covers in place on AM gear. Anytime you're working in an RF circuit, the covers are there. They're not there for protection necessarily, although they are that too, but they have an effect on the tuning. I hear Chris laughing back there. I'm betting there's a war story. Maybe we'll get him to tell it later. Okay, so safety considerations, like I said, lockouts, interlocks. Has anybody got a piece of equipment that has any interlock bypassed? Nobody's going to admit to it. Has anybody ever seen a transmitter? I'm going to pick on a tube transmitter for a second with an airflow interlock bypassed. Even if it was somebody else's, okay? It's not yours, it was a friend's. There we see. Okay, those things are there for a reason. Yes, they're inconvenient. Yes, they can cause things to trip. But if it's bypassed, the reason that you had to bypass it needs to be resolved as quickly as you can. Has anybody ever seen what happens in a transmitter with the airflow interlock bypassed and then the blower fails on the squirrel cage? And has anybody ever tried to sweep a tube socket off the floor of a transmitter? I mean, it will melt the tube right down through. It's nothing to do with the transmitter. If you're not cooling it and you interlock or bypass the protection desired to protect it because it's not getting cooled, bad stuff will happen. Okay, so again, practical troubleshooting. Number one, maintenance. Make sure your interlocks all work. Number two, when something stops working, many times it'll be an interlock. I spent 3 hours one day troubleshooting a transmitter that was going down, wouldn't come up, no alarms. What we found was that a contactor micro switch in the antenna system had failed and was holding the inhibit down on the transmitter, the RF kill. It took us 3 hours to find something that I should have been able to find in about 15 seconds. This wasn't one of my better days. Okay. This comes back to the first one where we saw the ground strap missing. A little bit of grounds maintenance, okay, keeping the greenery trimmed down, both for security and in AM sites for operation. Yeah, Chris, you got a minute.
A thought on those of you who have had to spray weed killer around the base of an AM tower. depending on what kind of weed killer you use, you ought to take a look at what some of those weed killers, namely the one I'm familiar with that I saw the damage right away, Roundup, can do to the copper. It advances the oxidation rate of the copper by about 10,000 to 1. So be careful with what you use for weed killer around the base of your tower.
And a quick postscript to that, you can, if you're on good speaking terms with your local electric utility, call up your utility rep and get recommendations for what they use for weed control around their facilities.
So there you go. I've got 20 seconds to go. Has anybody got any questions? I'm assuming I'm at the end. Questions, comments, suggestions, or war stories? Uh-oh.
One thought earlier, you mentioned the advantage of keeping things clean. I've found that the act of cleaning out a piece of gear is the way to do a good visual inspection, because you're physically touching everything, you're looking closely, getting the dust out of the corner or whatever, and so you're getting a double benefit out of that.
That's a very good point. And one other thing to add on to that real quick, I've hit the zero mark, somebody's going to come drag me out of here soon. I like the old days when Linda just stand back at the door with her watch going like this. But one of the other things to think about is that when you're cleaning a piece of equipment, I try to avoid compressed air that will just take the dust from a location where it wasn't arcing and relocate it to a location where it could. Okay, use vacuum, use damp rags, use the vacuum like a little computer or vacuum with a bristle brush. But try to avoid compressed air when at all possible. Now you can, I've seen guys use scuba quality air, very clean, very dry, and they claim it works great. Well, if you've got a system that works and you're doing some cleaning, then I'm not going to be the guy to try to stop you from doing that.
If you use compressed air, just hold the vacuum cleaner by it.
Yep, exactly, use the vacuum as well. Okay, there's lots of ways to find us. I'm sure this is all going to be on the website later. WBA, I signed all the permissions and said, yeah, you can have it. Thank you very much, folks.